You're listening to Conversations with John Anderson, featuring Andrew Robertson.
Well, Andrew, thank you for joining with me in this series of conversations. I have here a quite remarkable photograph taken in 2017. You're standing beside then Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull. You're on board the Intrepid. You're there with a number of other Australian former naval personnel and American vets, celebrating the 75th anniversary of the Battle of the Coral Sea, a major event in Australia's history, but perhaps not well understood, although this received quite a bit of publicity at the time. And of course, President Trump was there along with 700 other people in the hangar of that World War II aircraft carrier. Can you tell us something about the significance and the importance of the Battle of the Coral Sea?
Yes, I wasn't in the battle itself. I joined soon afterwards in the flagship of the task force, which was combined Australian-American task force under a British Admiral, Admiral Crutchley, Victoria Cross. And we sort of controlled the Coral Sea. And the battle itself, of course, was indeed the battle for Australia. It used to be celebrated all over Australia in a very big way with speeches and balls and marches and everything else, but this has rather fallen by the wayside in recent years. But the battle itself, of course, was the first ever naval battle where ships never sighted each other. It was all involved aircraft. And the Australian-American task force was attacked by the Japanese, of course, and by one of our allies by mistake at one stage. But the battle itself really, it ensured that the Coral Sea was held from then on by the Allies, and that meant there could be a New Guinea campaign, there could be an advance north to eventually attack Japan itself. If the battle had gone the other way and the carrier Yorktown had been sunk and the Japanese had continued with their assault of the Japanese fleet, they could have attacked anywhere they liked and bombarded our cities with carriers, battleships, cruisers, everything, and anywhere they liked in Australia, particularly the East Coast, where their fleet was largely concentrated. So it was, in fact, the battle that ensured that Australia was not itself invaded, if the Japanese had wished to. History seems to indicate they thought it would be too big a task. But it was one of the very great battles that decided much of the future of Australia.
Well, you were a young man at the time. You had joined the Navy at the age of 13 or 14, not long before the war. Tell us about that.
Yes, I joined the Navy in January 1939, at the age of 13. It was, of course, a very different Navy then. It was quite small. We had five modern cruisers, it's true. We had a few old destroyers, no submarines, no aircraft carriers, nothing like that. And most of the Navy was at sea. There were very few people ashore. I joined in Western Australia from a little bush school and was sent across the continent to, I was the only one from Western Australia, to join the Naval College in Southern Victoria. A very exciting and rather daunting trip.
So let's tease out something that you said there that was very interesting. It was a small Navy. Now, you'd had the cataclysmic events of World War I, but at that time, Australia seemed to be fully awake to the fact that the world was a dangerous place and had a very significant Navy. We celebrate, we see unbelievable numbers of young Australians turning out to acknowledge the importance of Anzac, the whole First World War. It seems to me that we were much more ready for that than we were for the Second World War.
I think this is absolutely true. Both Deakin and Fisher, the Prime Minister and the opposition leader, were very alive to the threat to Australia in World War I. And although we were only a country of 4.5 to 5 million people, they took the decision in 1908, I think it was, to create an Australian fleet. And they created it at the second level of naval power with a very modern, newly built battle cruiser as the centre of the fleet. Cruisers, destroyers, submarines, and all the support vessels involved. They did that with the full and huge support of Britain, and the fleet arrived, of course, in 1913, just before, a year or so before the war.
And only four or five years after it had been decided to elevate ourselves into a serious
global
player. That's
right, the country united, and they created the although the British, of course, provided a lot of the officers and key personnel, Australia got right behind it, had its own fleet in 1913 in a mere four or five years. And of course, at that stage, the Germans had a very powerful fleet in the Pacific, and they, of course, were occupying the New Guinea, the northern coast of what we now call Papua New Guinea, and New Britain and New Ireland and all the islands north of that, the Carolines and so on, and Samoa. And the first action of World War One was, in fact, the dispatch of the fleet with the army to take those German possessions, which they did. And after that, most of our ships operated with the Royal Navy in various parts of the world, particularly the Mediterranean. And Australia was wide awake, and we had this very strong naval power in World War One.
And as we know, our army performed brilliantly.
Absolutely brilliantly. And when you think of the short time in which we created that enormous force that we eventually deployed to particularly the Middle East in World War One, and the way in which it was deployed with the tremendous strength of the British fleet and our own, and of course of the British Merchant Marine, which was key to the war. A lot of people don't realise that both World War One and World War Two were fundamentally maritime wars. They were wars to bring the power of the British Empire from India, from Australia, from South Africa or wherever, to wherever it was needed, which in that case was in Europe and the Middle East, and then to bring the huge power of the United States across the Atlantic. This required naval power in all its facets. It's often forgotten. The same was the situation broadly in World War II, when it was in fact a maritime war initially to bring the armies and the air forces to where they were used and able to eventually finish the war.
We'll come back to that issue of Australia as an island nation in a moment, but before we do, I just wanted to explore a bit more this theme, because it seems to me to be incredibly important. Little nation, 4.5 million, 5 million people, alert, awake, understanding what was happening in the world, determined to defend itself and its values and its freedoms in the build-up to the First World War. The 1930s, it seems to me that Britain, you know, the mother country, the most powerful nation on earth, itself was in denial for a long time. We seem to have been incredibly complacent during the 1930s, and yet in many ways it should have been evident that the dangers of Nazism and what was happening in Japan were probably more frightening and more threatening to our long-term security and safety and freedoms than what was happening with those sort of destabilised Europe earlier in the century. Why were we so less willing to wake up and get ready in the 1930s, do you think?
Well, it's a strange thing, you see. I believe that's roughly true. Of course, Australia was emerging from the terrible Depression, which was only a few years before, as was Britain.
And America.
And America.
Which was also asleep.
And all these countries were really asleep until, and of course, a lot of thinkers in Australia realised the danger when the Japanese occupied, first of all, Manchuria, and then China itself, and that was an extremely worrying thing. But Australia didn't really wake up until very late in the day. And fortunately, the naval side had made certain proportions, certain precautions had been taken. And the army, of course, cooperated in a very big way. And there were coastal defences put in, including anti-submarine defences. And the Captain Cook dock, which was vital later in the war to take the biggest ships in the world, started, and the plans had been laid down, and that was eventually started at the beginning of the war. So some precautions were made, but the actual navy itself was very small, and yes, the cruisers were very efficient, and they were modern, but they were a very small force compared with what clearly was going to be the threat from our north.
I assume that part of the laziness emanated from the idea that Britain, perhaps not the greatest economic power compared to America by then, but certainly had the most powerful navy, that their navy, there was an assumption, would be able to fight on multiple fronts at once. So even if everything went wrong in Europe and in Japan, the navy would be able to fight on at least two, perhaps two and a half fronts, so to speak. But after the, if you like, winding back of naval powers in the 1921 Washington Agreement, it was probably unrealistic anyway to think that Britain could do that. And that became evident, I think, with the sinking of the Repulse and the Prince of Wales.
I think that's absolutely correct. I think in one aspect, though, of course, was that it wasn't just the British Navy, because the French Navy was extremely powerful and France was Britain's close ally. And of course, the collapse of the French and then the terrible problem of the French fleet, which if it had joined with the Germans and Italians would have overwhelmed what was left of the rather damaged Royal Navy. And I think that a great deal of reliance had been put on the defence of Singapore. And of course, to give Britain its due, they dispatched 50% of their fast battleships and carriers, battle cruisers, that's the Prince of Wales and the Repulse, and the carrier that went with them ran aground, unfortunately, and didn't make it. But they were still fighting, of course, the German fleet and the Italian fleet, and this was a huge sacrifice to send them for the defence of Singapore. If those ships had got through into the Japanese invasion fleet of northern Malaya, things would have been very different. But it was the same day, of course, as Pearl Harbor, and it was all a huge disaster. And we were then really rather wide open.
Well, those observations seem to be very important to me. In a recent conversation with Kim Beazley, a very distinguished former defence minister from the other side of politics from me, a remarkably fine Australian, very perceptive, we both, I think, found ourselves reinforcing one another's views that Australia needs to guard against complacency. The world is, at the moment, a worrying place, and we need to be prepared, I think, in every way. But we'll come back to that. To return to the question of what was happening when you were a young man in the Navy, of course, there was a sort of famous switch from looking to Britain to looking to America. The Battle of the Coral Sea was the first setback, really, that the Japanese suffered. The Americans, extraordinarily, once they realised that the war wasn't going to go away. A little footnote in history is that the American Embassy foundation stone was laid on the Saturday night before Pearl Harbor in Canberra, symbolising perhaps the changing relationship that was about to descend upon us. And of course, at that very time in the United States Senate, there were still senior Americans saying, we must not be drawn into war, we will stay out of this. A matter of hours later, Pearl Harbor and America's engaged. They geared up astonishingly quickly. They demonstrated that when a democracy, even when it's been slow to respond, sees its freedoms threatened, it will respond very vigorously indeed. Do you think the same would apply today?
Well, it's interesting. You see, when World War II finished, Australia was wide awake to the danger that it had been in. And we went very soon after the war, and as the Cold War was on the horizon, we went into aircraft carriers And we introduced the first one in 3 years.
3 years.
Which is incredible, with great British help. And then, of course, later in the 60s, as the Cold War really very strong, and the danger of war at any moment with the Soviet Union was very great indeed. The Australian government had taken a great deal of precautions, and we introduced submarines starting about 1964. At the same time, we went American in our big warships and introduced the guided missile destroyers. At the same time, we built ship frigates here, and we got a tanker and all sorts of things. And we did all that in 5 years to bring submarines from nothing, no background since the J-class, and to bring in American ships with absolutely everything different. Everything on board was different, from where there's guns and to introduce big missiles at the same time. These were huge steps, and Australia took all those steps and did it all very quickly, with great help from Britain and great help from America. And that must not be underestimated. But we were wide awake at the height of the Cold War. Then as the Cold War finished and the Berlin Wall came down and so on, Australia seemed to lose interest in its own defence. The carrier was not replaced, so we lost our fleet air arm that we'd taken 35 years to build up to be a most effective force. The Russians couldn't do it then. The Chinese couldn't do it then. Nobody could do it in the Indian Pacific Oceans and the local powers in those days, but we could. And we had done all that and we threw it away. Then we didn't replace the American guided missile ships when they came to the end of their lives until the Howard government ordered the new air warfare destroyers, which are now coming into service. And so you had an Australia which sort of felt its distance and other problems, internal and so on, and development of the nation. They could forget about international affairs and how things in far distant countries, in fact, would affect Australia's future. This was a very upsetting to be in the Navy and see this happening. But that's what happened, and we more or less let our armed forces drift down. We still kept the Air Force in reasonable strength, and that was great. But we let our army come down to a very small force. And today, as well as the Navy, which should be rebuilt as fast as we can, and we should be moving into the latest technology and everything, and our Air Force, which is reasonably equipped and getting new aircraft and so on, we need to pay attention to our Army, which is now far too small, given the sort of roles that it would require, not only in our whole island continent and everything involved in the defence of our ports and airports and our infrastructure and everything else, but in the island areas around us to go to their aid and so on. And we need to look at our defences in a big way, and we need to be doing it right now, and we need to be waking up because, as Mr. Spence, the Vice President of the United States under the present administration, said, we're more moving into a new form of Cold War.
That was a very significant speech. It's a pity it's not been more widely understood. Just go back to the Cold War for a moment and the coming down of the Berlin Wall. It seems to me that in many ways we can say, well, that happened because the West stood united. It was strong and unified and prepared to make it plain it meant business. And the result was a very desirable end to the Cold War. The Berlin Wall came down. Perhaps the West then assumed that freedom and democracy, free enterprise, the principles that the West founded on had won out. There was a sort of unipolar global order headed up by the Americans. We assumed that we could all relax until terrorism became an issue. That's given us a bit of a shake-up. The reality, though, is that the world now has become a multipolar world again. You've got the re-emergence of Russia. You've got Iran. You've got North Korea. You've got the very real, we have to be blunt about this, possibility for miscalculation between the superpower and the rising superpower. The issue of how many fronts could the superpower of the day actually handle if something went wrong? We thought Britain could handle several fronts at once, and we were wrong to assume that. It wasn't a question of their willingness to help, it was their capacity. Can we assume that the Americans would have the ability, if one of those trouble spots were to flare up, rapidly followed by others? Are we assuming that we can, if you like, have defence on the cheap?
Well, I think that is a very good question. You see, America also let her armed forces drift down in a very big way, and Britain likewise. So you have the situation now where the American fleet, which used to be 1,000 major combatants, is down to 275. And the first thing Mr. Trump did when he came in the Trump administration, was say they're going to build it up as fast as they can to 355 or something of that order. In the case of Britain, Britain let her navy wither on the vine till it was really an absolute shadow of its former self. And I think the point you raise is absolutely correct. If the Cold War moves into a hot war and you never know what comes out of the left field that nobody's ever thought about, then the chances of America being able to help in our neck of the woods are very small. They could help in small ways, but they will be stretched to the limit in dealing with the problems that they will face themselves. An awful lot of people seem to think that wars now are things of the past. History doesn't show that. They all thought that World War I would be the finish of wars, but it wasn't. World War II wasn't the finish of wars. Everybody hoped that the League of Nations after World War I, the United Nations after World War II, would solve the problems between the powers. It isn't so. In fact, you could argue that while the United Nations has done a great deal of good in many human rights and human areas of tragedy, in the question of great power rivalry and sorting out the big problems facing the world, it has failed.
Let's then move on to the question again of, if you like, the first responsibility of the federal government really is the security and the defence of its people and the maintenance of our values and our way of life. And that requires, I think, a strong economy, and it requires careful attention to diplomacy, international affairs, and defence. I wonder, in an age when a staggering number of Australians, particularly younger Australians, have serious doubts about democracy, the basis of the way we live together, they have little awareness of Australia as an island surrounded by seas, for example. They have probably a wide range of views on whether or not defence matters. Whether the question of national cohesion and belief in ourselves needs to be raised. Do we believe in ourselves? Are we committed to one another and to our values enough to say we will stand for them? We will seek to take, I'm a great believer, can't think of anything more. I grew up with a father who'd been in the 9th Division, almost lost his life, wasn't expected to leave, he was so badly injured in Monty's great push against Rommel. He loathed war. But I've always taken out of that that if you, it's the old saying you find in nearly every culture in various forms, if you want to prevent war, prepare for it.
That's right.
Do you think we understand that well enough in Australia, or are we somehow assuming that we're nice people in the world, we'll just go on behaving as though we should be left to our own devices?
Well, I think that what you've said is absolutely right. I think in Australia we've been so, as a nation, and I know there are pockets of great poverty and so on, but as a nation we've become extremely wealthy, and as such we're now 25 million people. When we were 4.5 to 5 million, we took care of our defence. Now we're 25 million, we seem to think that we're all okay, that nobody, our distances are fine and there couldn't be a war and the trade will all solve all the issues and all these sorts of things. And we haven't taken responsibility for our own defence. We're 25 million people among the wealthiest little countries in the world. We are surrounded by a large moat, but we've got to make sure that that moat, the island structures are all in our general area, that we help, we become great friends to, and that we can defend our own neck of the woods. And this requires fundamentally naval and air power, but it also requires a strong and mobile and highly effective army. And that's the ADF as a whole. But we have to wake up while there's still time.
As you say, we are quite a wealthy country, but here's something that staggers people when I say it to them. Russia is seen as a global power. People are concerned about what Russia might do. They're aware that it's very powerful. The Australian economy is the same size as Russia's. No one sees us as a threat, and we don't want to be a threat. We simply want to be seen as people who will stand up for our values and play a constructive role if someone needs to enforce the peace. But it's an interesting point, isn't it, that we sometimes hear people say, oh, no, if anything nasty happens, we're not big enough to make a difference. When we were 4.5 million people, we were able to build a second-tier navy and be massively instrumental in the outcome of the First World War on the battlefields. We celebrate that every year. Even in the Second War, when we finally got our act together, we played a critical role in a couple of the major battles of the Second World War. Now, there seems no excuse for us, in an age when we can't assume that the superpower of the day, once it was Britain, now it's America, will be fully able to support us if something goes wrong. Surely we ought to be able to step up and recognise our size, our wealth, and the desirability of standing for the freedoms that we think matter.
I think that is absolutely correct. And as you mentioned earlier, in slightly different words, the greatest welfare for our nation, the central welfare, is the security of the people, externally as well as internally. We have turned very much internally, and that's fully understandable with some of our people wanting to throw bombs and all this sort of thing. But externally, we have rather lost the plot. Not entirely, but we need to really look at our position in the world, and we really must consider it's all a question of priorities. You mentioned Russia, and Russia's priority is to build vast armed forces and make sure that the country can do what it wants, really, I suppose. But in our case, we have organised our priorities so that while we look after one side of welfare of the people in terms of the world standards, very highly, but in the other side, which is the security of the nation, that side of our welfare we have neglected.
To be fair, there has been good progress made in recent years. The Navy is undergoing a significant rebuilding. We've got the Air Force being re-equipped. Some things, good things are happening in the Army. And of course you've seen a good bipartisan cooperation on foreign interference in Australian politics, academia, media, yes, and so forth. Those things are to be welcomed. But it strikes me that there are two areas which stand out as beacons of our complacency. You mentioned it took, 4 or 5 years to get a second-tier navy from the moment of decision to having it here, sailing through the heads before the First War. You talked about the extraordinary way in the Cold War in which over a five-year period we invested in new ships out of America, new submarines, taught our people how to operate submarines. We do not have in Australia today, after many years of it being obvious it was going to be a problem, the strategic fuel reserves we need to keep the country, the economy, and the defence forces going if something goes wrong. That's one area of complacency that I find, frankly, deeply disturbing. And the second area is one that I think you will have some strong views on as a former naval man. 10 years ago, it was agreed with some urgency that we needed a new modern submarine fleet 10 years ago, and we're still at the point of being uncertain as I speak now as to the sign-off on those. The earliest any of them might arrive would be the mid-30s, still a long way away ago, leaving an enormous gap in the meantime. Why are we not able to move faster as a nation when we recognise, on a bipartisan basis, I think it was widely recognised, way back 10 years ago, that we needed to move, that in fact, and to put some numbers around it, that the Chinese would have around 70 submarines in the water by 2020. My understanding is that they got there well ahead of that date. We still haven't finished ordering and designing ours.
Well, I think that what you're saying is something that the nation must really closely look at. Perhaps one should consider that we used to have a policy where we built in Australia whatever we could in our navy. So we built frigates, and of course we bought the first of the American guided missile frigates from overseas. They were built in Bay City in America. Then we started building them here. And that was a very sensible policy. We got organized, and then we followed on from what we'd bought overseas. And you look at the submarine question, and we seem to have decided that we will go straight to building and designing our own submarine. Well, we certainly have the reason for the requirements of what a submarine in Australia must be able to do. But one of the great things is, of course, the speed of deployment undetected in a submarine. And this is very important to governments, and to democratic governments in particular, and governments of an island nation like us, because we have vast distances. So the speed of deployment undetected, or you hope undetected, is exceedingly important. We seem to have decided that we can't look at the question of nuclear propulsion. Well, nuclear propulsion, I think a lot of people think it's a little bang going on all the time, which might make a big bang in a submarine. I first did trials with a British nuclear-powered submarine, went to sea in it, 51 years ago. 51 years ago. As far as I'm aware, there's never been any question of a nuclear problem of any dimension in any British, American or French submarine. And they've had them for 50, 60 years. Now, for some of us, believe that we must not send our young men and our young women to sea deep in the oceans in a very dangerous environment in anything but the most efficient, effective and survivable boat there is. And that, to some of us, would mean that we should be going nuclear, with its fast deployment, with its capabilities which are so much greater than any conventional submarine. It can chase targets and overtake them because of its speed. It can be deployed quickly. It can get out of the way quickly. And indeed, it doesn't have to put anything above the sea. Anything you put above the sea now can be detected. And you may have satellites that tell you something. You're within a couple of feet of, a couple of meters of something. And Australia must not drift back in technology compared with other countries in the world. We must look to the future, and we must look and say, not it's too difficult, but how can we do it? When we were going into submarines, there were people who said, oh, this would be too difficult. We haven't been in submarines for 20, 30 years. It would be impossible. Well, the answer was, you get people who can say, we're going to do it. How do we do it? And I think this is what needs to be done right now, and it needs to be explained to the people. And I'm sure if they thought about it, to send our young men and women to sea, they should be in the best possible environment.
You're saying very clearly that the survivability, if something goes wrong, the safety of young men and women seeking to defend the country is better secured in nuclear-propelled submarines than in conventionals?
Yes. I'm not a submariner, and I'm in there are certain circumstances where a conventionally powered submarine is maybe arguably slightly better than a nuclear, but overall the nuclear-powered submarines are far better in so many, many ways. And that's the situation. That is why China is going nuclear in its propulsion, why India has gone nuclear in its propulsion. It's why Britain and America stopped building conventional submarines many decades ago. This is the situation. The French continued, not least for foreign sales, and the Germans, of course, produce conventional, and the Japanese. The Japanese haven't got the same problem that we've got. Of distance.
To those who would say then that there are a lot of shallow waters to the north of Australia and that diesels can sit quietly in the weeds, so to speak, in those situations where nuclears can't and remain undetected, do you have a response to that?
I have a response to that. If you go in shallow water in any submarine, and remember the conventional submarines now and the ones we're building, they're smaller than the nucleus, but not all that amount smaller. If you go into shallow waters, like the Arafura Sea or somewhere, you give away one of your three great advantages, because you no longer have the advantage of your third dimension, which is depth. So instead of being able to go down to 1,000 or to 300 meters or something, you can't. There ain't no water under there. So you're stuck with going left, right, and that's it. You can't use your other tremendously great advantage of using the depths.
And to those who would say, well, by the time we get these submarines, they'll be obsolete technology because you could take them out with new technologies, they'll be irrelevant. Is the traditional argument that effective submarines are an incredibly powerful and important deterrent for an island nation like Australia becoming redundant, in your view?
No, I don't think so. I think it's almost the reverse. A properly equipped, with the right weapons systems, submarine, and if you remember the, let's take the Iraq War. Our TV showed missiles, Tomahawk missiles, fired from destroyers or submarines, fired from perhaps 1,000 kilometres away, I don't know, some distance, I'm not privy to the secrets of these things any longer, going through the windows of the headquarters of the Iraqi army in Baghdad. The submarines, because you've got to detect them, well, there are lots of detection devices today, and it's much better than it used to be in many ways, but they're still hard to find, particularly if they can move as a nuclear-powered submarine might do, or 700 miles or more in a day. You've got a big problem on your hands dealing with them. And of course, this means that you can, in fact, a nuclear-powered submarine can stay at sea if the engines keep going, for as long as the crew can last, because you don't have to refuel them. And in our, you mentioned this question of fuel security, I agree entirely we should be looking extremely carefully at our fuel reserves in this nation. We not only have let them run down and close some of our oil refineries, we're not nearly in a position as good as we were in World War II, from what the press says. This seems to be so. But there are many other aspects. We no longer have a merchant marine of any size, or it's half a dozen ships or something. And we would depend on everybody else's ships to bring the oil into Australia. And of course, shipping would be one of the first things which everybody would attack for the very reasons I said earlier on.
And then the owners of those ships would say, well, we're not going to Australia, or we're not carting their oil in, or we're not bringing their armaments in. We can't get insurance if something went wrong.
All these things could happen. No doubt that people have worked out what might be a solution, but if you lose control of the oceans around you, you're finished, because we depend so much. Let's forget trade, just think of the importance of the imports that we have to bring in. Yes, aircraft can bring a lot of things in. They have to be refueled probably when they get here. That's one question. They can bring a lot in, but not the big heavy stuff that we would need if we have to defend the country.
Oh, and the sheer quantities of oil we'd need just to keep our domestic
economy
going.
Absolutely.
People overlook that. They really do. We've got dangerously close in recent years to running out of diesel. Diesel's the fuel that keeps everything going. Our trains moving for, you know, heavy freight, for moving groceries around, our trucks taking medical supplies to outback towns, let alone the groceries. It's actually, in my view, quite a serious issue, and I can't believe it's not being taken more seriously.
Well, there are a lot of things that sinews of the defence of the nation, which one would hope that were being examined very closely. We need to look at all the sinews very closely. I think we're starting to realise the importance of our own infrastructure being in Australian hands, or subject to very, very strong Australian control. And I think we're starting with all this, and it is great. We've got to speed the whole thing up, because we must not find ourselves in a situation where decisions are being made in capital cities elsewhere in the world which affect our ability to defend ourselves.
Well, Andrew, thank you very much for this. I hope that people will recognise the enormous benefit of understanding history in general, and our own in particular. When we have been awake and prepared, we've been in a better position all the way through. Nothing changes that, surely. And at a time when I feel we're too focused on tearing one another apart over all sorts of issues that in the end just see us arguing with ourselves rather than focusing on the things that should unite us. And we do face a very uncertain economic and strategic global outcome. The lessons of history are that it may not repeat itself exactly, but it always rhymes, and we should be awake. Well, as we draw this to a close, there are two issues I'd like to round off with that I think are very, very important. There are many people who say Australia should have a more independent foreign policy. My personal view would be that we may have to be capable of running a more independent foreign policy at some point in the future, but that it can't happen if you don't look like you actually mean it and have the capability to apply some teeth.
I think that is absolutely right. I'd go further than that, and I'd say that you must present to the world that in fact you're a tough nut to crack. You may have great resources and things that people really like, but if you're a tough nut to crack with strong defence forces, you are in a much greater position to preserve peace. And of course, this goes back to the teaching of history. And the teaching of history should start in our schools with some of these very great strategic questions of the survival of an island continent, which has a great advantage of distance, but it's got to use it. And it goes well beyond, of course, schools. We need the leadership of the nation to be telling the people what they've got to become as a nation of 25 million now, which might be 50 million in a few decades' time, that can look after itself and is a tough nut to crack on, and it's going to defend its democracy and it's going to defend its culture.
Well, that was the other point I was going to raise. You've just touched on it. It's really important that we understand history. And the value of this conversation, I think, is in many ways bound up with the extraordinary perspective you have over a very long time of involvement with defence forces. But surely that lesson of history is that whilst it may never repeat exactly, it always rhymes. What's happened in the past is always provides a valuable classroom for the future. I do worry that we don't teach history comprehensively and in a coordinated way, and that it's often, to be blunt about this, ideologically driven. Facts are facts. Military facts, particularly of military facts. Military people spend a lot of time, as do economists, by the way, studying history so that they can avoid the mistakes of the past. Surely it's time we tried to make certain that our children, who are plainly interested and get the general drift of how important that is, you see that every Anzac Day service, to make sure that they actually do know what happened, what prices were paid for our freedoms, and how we can avoid having them threatened readily in the future.
I think that this is correct. One of the aspects of this, of course, is our migration program. Now, in World War One and World War Two, we were both basically, we had all our arguments and all the problems that go on in democracies, but we were basically very cohesive nations. And when the bells rang and then people said, get in the army, start, get in the navy, get in the air force, get going, we did exactly that. And we have to teach our young, and particularly our immigrants, many of whom come from countries without a maritime history as we know it, the sinews of Australia's defence, the sinews of our history that we pass on to our children. And we must concentrate to a huge degree on the cohesion of the nation, speaking English well, really prepared to defend our democracy and our culture. And if we get away from that, then you may find that Australia becomes indefensible.
And of course, very many of those immigrants have come here looking for freedom, and they'll tell you so. And they will often say, I have this happen a great deal. We wish Australia was a bit more alert. We came here looking for freedom. We've found it. We don't want to lose it. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Conversations with John Anderson. For further content, visit johnanderson.net.au.